Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Transnational Fraud Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 29, 2010, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Morrison v. National Australia Bank. This case concerns the extraterritorial reach of Section 10B of the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934. To discuss the case, we have Hofstra University School of Law Professor Ronald J. Colombo. Professor Colombo joined an amicus brief in support of the respondent. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Colombo.
Hello, my name is Ron Colombo, and I'm an associate professor of law at Hofstra University School of Law. In this podcast, I'll be examining the case of Morrison versus National Australia Bank, in which the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral argument on March 29, 2010. Morrison is an example of an F-cubed or foreign-cubed case, meaning a securities fraud case involving a foreign plaintiff suing a foreign company with regard to shares of that company purchased on a foreign securities exchange. And the issue presented by such cases is whether or not Rule 10b-5, the general anti-fraud provision contained in the 1934 Securities Exchange Act, can be applied to them. In other words, can a plaintiff bring a lawsuit in a United States court alleging violation of Rule 10b-5 on account of securities fraud if the plaintiff is foreign to the United States, if the defendant is foreign to the United States, and if the securities are purchased on a market foreign to the United States? This question has troubled the federal judiciary for quite some time and has now, finally, made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's back up now and explore the fact of Morrison versus National Australia Bank, along with the holding of the lower court, which was the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Thereafter, we'll look at how the oral argument before the Supreme Court transpired and hazard a guess as to how the case might be decided. Let's start with the defendant in this case, National Australia Bank, or NAB. NAB bills itself as Australia's largest bank, and it holds hundreds of billions of dollars in assets. It has issued approximately 1.5 billion ordinary shares of stock. And yes, I said ordinary. That's the Australian equivalent to American common stock. And these shares trade on the Australian, London, Tokyo, and New Zealand stock exchanges. One of NAB's subsidiaries since 1998 is Homeside Lending, Inc., an American mortgage service company headquartered in Jacksonville, Florida. Since its acquisition by NAB in 1998, Homeside's profits were included in NAB's net profit totals. And these profits were fairly substantial, amounting to $153 million in 1999 and $141 million in 2000, or 5.4% and 4.1% of NAB's total profits, respectively, for those years. Or so everyone thought, for it turns out that Homeside had been engaging in certain questionable accounting practices. More specifically, Homeside had been overestimating the value of its mortgage servicing business by using incorrect interest assumptions in its valuation model. This made its profit numbers inaccurate. As a result, NAB announced in July 2001 that it was going to take a $450 million write-down due to a recalculation of Homeside's profitability. NAB's stock fell by more than 5% in response to the announcement. Another write-down was announced in September 2001, this time of $1.75 billion, and that write-down triggered a 13% drop in the value of NAB stock. None of this was particularly pleasing to the holders of NAB stock, and four individuals, including the named plaintiff, one Robert Morrison, brought suit against NAB, and also against Homeside and several allegedly responsible individuals, claiming securities fraud. What makes their suit so particularly interesting, and the reason I'm talking about it, is because of where and under what law they decided to file suit. In the Southern District of New York, asserting a violation of Rule 10b-5 of the 1934 Securities Exchange Act, which is a component of American, not Australian, securities law. In response to this lawsuit, NAB filed a motion to dismiss on a couple of grounds. One, lack of subject matter jurisdiction, and two, the failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. The motion to dismiss was granted by the district court. Plaintiffs appealed. In their appeal, plaintiffs did not challenge the district court's finding that, for some of the plaintiffs, the there was a failure to state a claim upon which relief could be granted. This had to do with a question of damages. Instead, plaintiffs focused solely in their appeal on the lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Whether subject matter jurisdiction exists turns on the jurisdictional reach of U.S. securities law in general and the anti-fraud rule 10b-5 in particular. Now, rule 10b-5 prohibits fraud in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. Its promulgation by the SEC was authorized by Section 10b of the 1934 Securities Exchange Act, the underlying purpose of which was to remedy deceptive and manipulative conduct with the potential to harm the public interest or the interest of investors. The critical question that the Second Circuit had to contend with in Morrison was whether Section 10b and Rule 10b-5 reaches transactions that take place outside of the United States, transactions by foreign investors in foreign companies on foreign markets. The text of Section 10b and of Rule 10b-5 is completely silent on that important subject. In the face of this silence, the Second Circuit held that Section 10b and Rule 10b-5 can indeed reach certain transactions that take place outside the United States. Whether these provisions reach such transactions depends upon the conduct test and the effect test, according to the Second Circuit. The conduct test looks into whether the wrongful conduct occurred in the United States. The effect test looks into whether the wrongful conduct had a substantial effect in the United States or upon U.S. citizens. Now, if both tests are passed, then subject matter jurisdiction would most likely exist under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5. If neither test is passed, then U.S. subject matter jurisdiction is highly unlikely. But if just one of these two tests is passed, the possibility of finding subject matter jurisdiction under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5, according to the Second Circuit, still persists. And since this was an F-cubed case, the plaintiffs, on appeal at least, were not asserting that the fraud had any effects in the United States. Plaintiffs had put all their eggs in the conduct test basket and were arguing for the exercise of U.S. jurisdiction on the basis of the conduct test alone. In discussing the conduct test, the Second Circuit said that it was important to distinguish between conduct that was merely preparatory versus conduct that directly caused the harm to investors. The former conduct, merely preparatory conduct, could not justify the exercise of U.S. jurisdiction. Only the latter conduct, conduct directly causing investor harm, could. In applying the conduct test, the Second Circuit held that the fraudulent conduct occurring in Florida, that is, Homeside's improper accounting methodology, was merely preparatory, and thus subject matter jurisdiction was lacking. According to the court, Homeside's misconduct was merely preparatory because it didn't directly harm investors. Investors were harmed by NAB's decision to incorporate Homeside's financials into its own and to publish these financials to the public. And all of that occurred in Australia. For this reason, the Second Circuit affirmed the district court's dismissal of the case. Obviously, the dismissal and this decision was a disappointment to the plaintiffs. But it was also a disappointment to several amici, who weighed in on the defendant's behalf. For as is quite clear, the Second Circuit does not categorically deny subject matter jurisdiction over F-cubed cases. Instead, the Second Circuit said that such cases must be put through the conduct test, and whether or not jurisdiction exists depends upon how that conduct test turns out. Now, the amici had pointed out and petitioned the Second Circuit to announce a bright line rule and to affirm the district court's dismissal on that ground. The bright line rule proffered was simple. Section 10b and Rule 10b-5 do not extend to F-cubed cases. The rationales for such a bright line rule are manifold. One, when statutes are silent as to their extraterritorial application, it is a matter of general statutory interpretation to apply them only domestically. Thus, Section 10b's silence as to its extraterritorial application should be interpreted as limiting its application to fraud affecting U.S. investors on U.S. securities markets. Two, the legislative history of the 1934 Act demonstrates that Congress was well aware of foreign securities markets and intentionally excluded them from the reach of Section 10b. Three, as a matter of public policy, U.S. courts are busy enough dealing with domestic securities fraud, and it's a poor use of our limited judicial resources to open up our courts to foreign investors who purchase stock in foreign companies on foreign exchanges. Number four, also as a matter of public policy, a bright line rule is far easier to administer and as a result more predictable than the conduct test employed by the Second Circuit. And fifth and finally, there are important substantive and procedural differences between U.S. securities law and the securities law of other nations. Applying U.S. securities fraud law to F-cubed transactions is a form of legal imperialism of sorts, under which the United States imposes its rules upon foreign investors suing foreign firms for fraud in foreign markets. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, allow me to mention that I have personally signed on to an amicus brief that has been submitted to the U.S. Supreme Court asserting adoption of this bright line rule for just these very reasons. Now, as I mentioned, the Second Circuit chose not to adopt a bright line rule. The Second Circuit downplayed the potential conflict between U.S. and non-U.S. securities law, basically saying that when it comes to fraud, we're all against it. Moreover, and perhaps more persuasively, the Second Circuit decried the exportation of fraud from the United States of America. The Second Circuit was uncomfortable with a rule, such as the Bright Line Rule, which would arguably protect a fraudster from suit in the United States just, and this is a quotation from the Second Circuit, just because they carry a foreign passport or victimize foreign shareholders. In any event, the case is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. Oral argument wasn't particularly eventful, and although it's dangerous to predict the court's ultimate holding based upon what transpired at oral argument, I'm fairly comfortable hazarding a guess that the court will affirm the Second Circuit's decision. The justices who spoke at all seemed fairly skeptical of petitioner's assertion that they could maintain the suit under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5. Justices Ginsburg and Scalia stressed how this case had Australia written all over it, in their own words. Justice Alito asked, where is the U.S. interest in this case? Justice Breyer pointed out that France, Britain, and Australia had all filed amicus briefs urging affirmance of the Second Circuit's opinion, which undercuts the argument that application of U.S. law in these situations wouldn't be too big a deal in terms of international comity. Perhaps predictably, the Department of Justice weighed in, arguing that a private right of action should not exist under these circumstances, but that the government of the United States and the SEC should be permitted to bring suit under these circumstances. So like I said, I think the court will affirm the Second Circuit's decision, and probably by a fairly lopsided margin. Indeed, the opinion could even be a unanimous one. The only open question appears to be the grounds upon which the court affirms the decision, and whether the court's decision applies to only private rights of action, or whether it extends to all actions under Rule 10b-5, including those brought by the SEC and the DOJ. Word has it that the Supreme Court should decide the case sometime this summer, by the end of June, most likely. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.